Stop the rock. Stop the rock. Stop the rock. Stop the rock. Can't stop the rock. You can't stop the rock. Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode 120, Lunch on a Beam. I'm your co-host Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and today our guest is Christine Roussel. She is the author of Lunch on a Beam, The Making of an American Photograph. And she has, I think, just about the coolest job in the world, which is the chief archivist of the Rockefeller Center in New York, where the famous photograph, Lunch on a Beam, of multiple construction workers during the Great Depression sitting high above Manhattan on a perilous-looking horizontal beam, comprised probably one of the most famous news photographs in the history of the country, if not the world. Christine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoy talking about this wonderful photograph and taking care of it. It's in the archive, of course.
Well, tell us a little bit about what is in the archive, because there's quite a lot of material in there, and how it arrived to you that this was, a book subject.
Well, the genesis of the book is very simple. I've been at the archives 20 years since I wrote my last book, which is The Art of Rockefeller Center. And that was a rather easy book to write because you look at the art, you describe it, you tell who created it, you describe the person, and you move on to the next sculpture, usually sculpture. This was quite a different book to write. The story of the man on the beam is muddled and distorted over years. Everybody had an opinion as to who took the picture, who's in the picture, why it was taken, all sorts of things. And nobody had the story straight, but I'll say most people didn't have the story straight. They attributed the taking of the picture to a million different photographers and ended up with, actually, I don't know who took the picture. And so it was kind of over the 20 years I became the archivist there that I was tired of answering the questions. And it also piqued my curiosity. How did this all come about? And why is it so famous? And why are so many people interested in this picture? And why do so many people find this picture meaningful? You know, what has an enormous impact, especially on first generation Americans? They love to talk about granddad. Granddad is the third man on the beam. If granddad is the third man on the beam, he has 18 grandchildren claiming that, at least. He's a very fatherly looking fellow, and he looks like everybody's grandfather, and a lot of people claim him to be the third man on the beam. You know, here's my grandpa Joe, here's my grandpa Tom, here's my grandpa Larry, and so forth and so on. It was for a variety of reasons. To satisfy myself, I thought I probably had another book in me to write, and this seemed like the book to write because the questions kept coming up. And there was a lot of material in the archive. The archive was formed in the 90s when Rockefeller Center was sold. And it was sold to a consortium of realtors, basically, Tishman Speyer being the operative realtor at Rock Center, and Rockefeller Group, who took the buildings on the west side of 6th Avenue. And they ended up, due to the great overlooking of a lawyer or two or three or a dozen, that they ended up with the archive. And Rockefeller Group ended up with the archive, the pictures, the actual information and pictures and documents. And Tishman ended up providing space for us to have these pictures and documents available. So it's kind of a meeting of the minds between the west side of 6th Avenue and the east side of 6th Avenue. You get it. It works out quite well. It is a very simple archive. I'm not at all digitized. It's manual. If you want to find something, you have to either know where it is or go look for it. There was very little structure to the archive when I was asked to take it over. I had just finished my other book, The Art of Rockefeller Center, and I was asked, hey, would you like to take over the archive? I said, well, I'm not an archivist. And they said, well, would you try it for a few months while we get an archivist? I said, yeah, sure, that would work out with my program. And so 20 years later, I think they're still looking for an archivist and seem to be happy with what I do. And I'm happy with them as bosses. So it works out quite well. And I learn a lot every day. People who come in to write a book, a lot of graduate students who are working on their thesis come in to write some aspect, usually of the architecture, but sometimes of a personality, you know, like John Todd, or will be researching John Rockefeller Jr. and they'll want to come in and see what papers and pictures I can provide to them. So it's a very hit or miss who walks in the door, who makes an appointment to walk in the door. And it's been a pleasure meeting people and talking to them over the years, and seeing some people go on to get their graduate degrees and really write, teach, and really have a good career ahead. And I feel like I've mentored some of them.
That sounds like a great experience. Well, you mentioned two people who whose names are already all over the Rockefeller Center for pretty obvious reasons. Maybe John Todd is not as well known. But the arc of the book is interesting. It's a little bit surprising in that it starts in the first few chapters really talking about the names you know and the financiers and the leaders of the operation. And then, you know, we kind of gradually get into the staging of the photograph, or multiple photographs, as it turns out. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about Junior and his vision and how this plays into what eventually happened with the hiring of a rather famous publicist who may have engineered this shot.
Okay, let me explain that I worked with Nelson Rockefeller, his son. We started a business together when I left the Metropolitan Museum, and I felt very privileged. My first real tour through Rockefeller Center was with Nelson, who invited me to take a tour one afternoon when we had had lunch. And we climbed through every hallway, doorway, place you can imagine. And it was an incredible afternoon, and sort of put a memory in my mind of how wonderful this place is and how proud the Rockefellers are of it. Nelson was extraordinarily proud of Rockefeller Center. His father ended up kind of, as they say in American slang, holding the bag, quite literally. He had joined a group looking to build a new opera house in New York, because the old opera house had a variety of problems, some of them political, some of them social, some of them sight lines, some of them real estate, where it was located. And so he joined this group to look into building a new opera house. Then the Great Depression hit hard on a Thursday afternoon, and all the people who were with him on this venture bailed out, leaving him holding property which he had actually leased from Columbia University. Everybody thought he had bought, people who come into the center to research think he had bought it, but it took him a number of years to buy it. He leased it from Columbia University for $3 million a year, and he collected rents of about $300,000 from a number of tenant dwellers who lived in the four-story brownstones and run-down buildings along 48th Street, 49th, 50th Street, so forth. So he got stuck with wondering what to do, and he decided basically to go ahead with the venture. And he met with John Todd. John Todd was a very aggressive builder himself, a man who built a number of buildings in New York. He was arrogant. He, by the way, Christy Todd Whitman, is his niece, I think, or grandniece, I'm not quite sure. But they have certainly impacted American life. John Todd loved horses, he loved dogs, he loved flowers, he loved money. He loved to be in charge. He was a perfect man to work with Junior, as John D. Rockefeller Jr. was called by his close companions. I doubt very much if a secretary said, "Oh, Junior, would you, like a cup of coffee?" I would think it would be Mr. Rockefeller. But Junior was the name that his close associates called him. And he worked very well with Todd because he had Junior, from what I understand from Nelson, who was basically afraid of his father. Whenever he talked about his father, you could see the capital F of father in his head and speaking. There was no doubt he was afraid of daddy, and daddy was never daddy, he was always father. So, but father was brilliant, and people don't give him credit for that because he had the way of hiring the right people for the right job and staying on top of them, but staying out of their way, if you know what I mean. They reported to him, he expected a lot of the people who worked for him. He never lost control of the situations he was in. Even if you go back to 1914, to the massacre at Ludlow, where one of his companies, who coal mining, had managed to massacre 20 some odd people. And really, he became the most hated man in America, according to Upton Sinclair and people like that. And it also, I think, this is very personal, I think Ludlow changed Junior from being a junior Rockefeller to realize he's in charge. And I think because he went down to Ludlow, he talked to the people in Ludlow, got a different story than he was getting from his underlings. And he realized, I have to be more skeptical, I think, of the information I'm getting. And so I think he grew up on Ludlow in an emotional way. Now, that's an opinion. I'm sure lots of people will say, "Oh, how'd you reach that opinion?" Just an opinion. Anyway, Junior hired John Todd. John Todd, as I said, was arrogant and brilliant and brought along his son, his brother, and all his colleagues and hired five architects to design a place. Now, the idea of the Opera House was to build the Opera House and have it surrounded by money-making places like hotel, shops, that kind of thing. But Todd saw that as being the way to go, but leave the Opera House out because the Opera House is closed 6 months out of the year. And it's a big dead building for 6 months out of the year. And he envisioned, let's say we can put lots of shops and lots of business buildings and tenants in those buildings and make a lot of money, and convinced Junior to go that way. So the Opera was out. Todd's vision sold to Rockefeller quite easily, I think. And they started with the group of five architects, the associated architects, including some outstanding people, the most outstanding, of course, being Raymond Hood. Raymond Hood died very young, like at 54, I think. And he had not a great career before he designed the Chicago Tribune building and the News building in New York. Those put his architectural, as an architect, on the books. He was solid. He was also a wild man. He spoke French fluently. He drank too much. He had a fear of his child being kidnapped because Lindbergh's child had just been kidnapped. He had a lot of different sides to him that people, he was very much liked by his companions and compatriots. He, Andrew Reinhardt worked with him, and Wally Harrison, who was married to a Rockefeller, actually. I think Wally wasn't, but his brother was married to Rockefeller's sister, daughter, I think. So those architects kind of divided up the work that was to be done. They worked very, very hard and very long, because Todd was a madman concerning timing. You know, every day that was where they weren't building or actually digging a hole in the ground to put a building in, he felt was a lost day. So he was pushing the architects as hard as he could to come up with a plan that they all considered to be reasonable. Reasonable translates to be financially advantageous. So they did come up with a plan. The plan is what you see when you visit the city within the city, as Rockefeller Center has been called many times. And it deserves that tribute, city within a city, because here you are in the middle of Manhattan and you get into Rockefeller Center and you've sort of come into another world. It's clean, it's guarded, it's peaceful, it's got a lot of shopping, a lot of places to eat lunch. And if you work there, it's a very nice place to work, because there are a lot of balconies or a lot of rooftop gardens to enjoy. And those have been increased over the years. So it becomes a nicer place to work and keeps up kind of with the modern world, which I think is amazing, because you look back to 1932 when they all were starting this. And you come today to, what are we, 80 some odd years on, and it still works, and it works better than most commercial buildings in New York City. The elevators run, the air conditioning runs in the summer, the gardens are beautiful, it's clean as a whistle. When Nelson took me on that tour through the center, we went down into the garage, and the garage, you go down this ramp, sort of a brick-covered floor ramp. It's a commercial kind of flooring. And you turn a corner, and you suddenly are on the other side. I don't quite get the geography of the ramp and the whole way it works, but you can go down from one side, and you can come up in a building completely across Rockefeller Center. You see no trash on the street. It's collected constantly. Trucks are lined up carefully to come in on a certain schedule. So there, you have a situation where there's no double parking, there's no honking, there's no trash, and it becomes another world, which is why it's been called, part of the reason why it's been called, a city within a city. Now, have I lost your question somewhere in all that rambling?
Not at all. I think you've brilliantly set the context, and you've put, I mean, in my circles where I work, everyone still looks to Rockefeller Center as the model of how you do an integrated development embedded in a living city. I mean, from Shanghai to Tokyo, wherever you go, people say, oh, this is going to be the Rockefeller Center of name your city.
I've seen that in the Gulf as well, and I've been literally flipping through my copy of Delirious New York while we're having this conversation too, because of course that's the epitome of Manhattanism, as Kuhlhaas called it back in the day. So yeah, it really is the center of everything.
That's interesting, because when I've been to Dubai a number of times, I've gone up in the Burj Khalifa, whatever it's called, and it's an adventure into the sky, but it's a completely different experience than Rockefeller Center. Rockefeller Center isn't an awesome spire going into the sky. It's a place where anybody can walk in and find to become comfortable. You can go into a deli close by, buy a sandwich, go and sit on a rock or rock bench in Rock Center and have your lunch and watch the people go by and watch the fountains work and see Prometheus gleaming in the sunshine. It's a completely different experience than the single tall building concept, which is most of what has been built. Look at the Empire State Building, a single building built looking upwards. Rockefeller Center not only looked upwards, it looked outwards, and it incorporated comfort zones for people and enticements for people. Come in, spend some time shopping, spend some time eating. Look around. Nobody's going to hassle you. It's great. It's an incredible concept.
Well, the urbanism of it is really top shelf. And I want to make sure we do reserve enough time to talk about the people in the photograph or the origins of the photograph. So maybe we switch gears a little bit to talk about the construction process and, you know, who was coming to work on the site and how it came to be that nobody knows who was in this photograph. And we still don't. Well, at least not definitively.
Well, okay, they were building Rockefeller Center, and we're in the height of the Depression, the beginning of the Depression, which lasted most of the years they were building Rock Center. And of course, they were looking at the Empire State Building, which was called the Empty State Building, because they couldn't lease all the space they had built. So of course, this worried Junior in particular, you know, we're building all this space, let's get people in. Well, they had a Junior had a PR person named Ivy Lee. Ivy Lee is called sort of a man who could manage to make anything acceptable. And he had a colleague called Kroll, Merrill Kroll. Merrill Kroll had been a publisher of a magazine called The American Magazine. Had a huge distribution, and he was hired to do the PR. Well, Merrill Kroll went with a vengeance after PR. He would invent things. He would invent, today we're having a load of iron or of steel delivered. We're having bricks delivered. We're having such and such an event. And he would, no matter what, get the Rockefeller Center, the building of Rockefeller Center, into the news. And he realized that the construction photographs that had been shot over the years and in the newspapers would shoot construction of the men walking the beam and things like that, and they sold papers that way, and people were interested. This sort of a sign of hope also. So he had a group of stringers of photographers, including Charlie Ebbets, Kelly, Thomas Kelly, and William Leftwich, among the photographers who went up in September 1932, in the middle of September 1932, and they were basically given the instructions is to take some terrific shots of the men working, because there was no way these shots existed without Kroll having absolutely blessed this event and probably provided the lunch boxes that some of the men were carrying. So you had cooperation from all ends. You had a bunch of iron workers who were delighted to be paid and eating lunch and getting attention like they'd never been given attention before, because who talks about an iron worker building a building? They talk about the architect, they talk about the financier, this kind of thing. So they were all up there and posing, and so obviously from the number of pictures that are in the archives, they were enjoying themselves. They were listening to the radio, they were lying down taking a nap, they were sitting as the most famous of all, shoulder to shoulder, eating their lunch on a beam. And this was all publicity. It worked because that photograph, Lunch on a Beam or Men on a Beam, it has both titles, or people use both titles, basically hit the press and became an icon of its own. People looked at it and said, not only are these men brave, these men are immigrants, these men have come from all different places. They come from Slovakia, they come from Ireland, they come from the Mohawk Reservation. That gradually came out as information. It wasn't known when the picture was published. It became part of the story later on. But it represented every man's struggle, potentially every man's struggle, an immigrant struggle, the people who lived here struggling through the Depression. It represented pride in work. It represented the most basic form of work can become imaginative and important and influential. You look at those 11 men confidently sitting on that beam. By the way, sometimes that picture makes my stomach turn over even today. I look at it and say, oh my God, what are they, crazy? But it hit the nerve of many places around the world, many people around the world. And they wanted to be associated with it, which I found very interesting. Over the years, I've been at the archives. The Irish love to keep, apparently, I helped two Irishmen with a film they made about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, called Men on a Beam. I did some voiceover work for them and helped them research the picture and other pictures. And they said to me, do you know that this picture hangs in every pub? It goes to college with every Irish kid who's ever been in college. It hangs in everybody's home who thinks that they have a relative on the beam. And every Irishman, by the way, thinks he has a relative on the beam.
I mean, for a lot of people, it's like the immigrant version of having been, you know, painted on the crossing of the Delaware or something. Like, it's like, yeah, that I'm part of the American story. Like, this is my family's stake in it. How, when you were interviewing these folks and then getting back to them about your findings, and how did you communicate to them what was going to ultimately end up in the book? Because the way that you show it in the book is you say, okay, here's my theory about who this is. The strongest evidence is that it's this person. But the records also seem to indicate that it might have been these following people. Was it difficult to talk to the families who were certain that it was their relative who was in that shot when you, or did you share with them before publication that, you know, what your ultimate findings were?
Well, some of them, without doubt, their father, in the case of Ubanek, for instance, they had a picture of him on, they had several pictures of him were walking iron. They had one that was hand-dated. They knew they had a clipping from the newspaper. They had a lot of proof, so-called. Most people only have family tales. My grandfather told my grandmother that about being on the beam. Well, there were a lot of pictures of men being taken, photographed on the beam, so perhaps he wasn't lying to grandmother. They were taking pictures of us being on the beam. That doesn't mean he was one of 11 sitting on the beam. Go back to your question. How do you say, I sincerely doubt that your grandfather or relative was one of the men on the beam? You can't say that. You can't destroy a family's belief in something that goes beyond just identification of a man. It's identification of being an American, of being able to outlive the Depression, being able to work incredible hours to survive and to build a family in America from nothing. And this is basically what these people are talking about. They're talking about survival, they're talking about pride, they're talking about family history, they're talking about a lot of things, and you cannot dismiss all of that. You have to say to them, in my opinion, I'm not sure that that is your grandfather, you know, and then let them wait for the book. It was a tough call occasionally because there was a lady, I think she lives currently in Michigan, but she believed, and she's in her 90s, she believed that her older brother and two other brothers were all three on the beam. Well, that's not possible. You know, it just simply, we had pretty much ascertained other people being on the beam. The other thing we had in the archives was a few pictures taken at that period, at that time, when the photographers, Leftwich, Kelly, and Evitz were shooting their pictures. They had made notations as to who they had shot. So we had a couple of names. We had a few names to go by in the beginning. And we could then cross-reference faces. And we worked very hard at that. And it was, I will tell you, it was a tough call to say, you know, he's been considered on the beam for all these years, but it's not possible. He is not a man on the beam. And so I hope in my book that I've been kind to people who read it and expect me to answer their prayers. We'll see what happens when it comes out. I may have to leave town.
Christine, I want to ask, if you could give us some context on what the construction of the RCA building and Rock Center was like, because, you know, in Delirious New York, you know, Kulhas has some funny anecdotes about sort of the battles between Todd and Hood over value engineering. And of course, famously, roughly the same time, you know, the Empire State Building had gone up, you know, with incredible speed. I bring it up because it's interesting, like, you know, I'm working on a project right now that notes like about how in the United States, like construction productivity has flatlined or even negative since 1970. You know, yeah, I guess I'm curious, like how, you know, was there any particularly innovative engineering techniques in this? And I'm curious your thoughts on like sort of how it was perceived then, right? Like we've built, you know, this is Dan's entire job over at CVU, but like we live truly in the era of skyscrapers now. And yet like so many other technologies, space travel, et cetera, there, it's become, you know, anodyne. It's just something that happens in the background. It wasn't something that's become, you know, and capture the imagination of the United States or the world kind of thing. So how was that project perceived as it went up in the midst of the Depression versus what was happening in Manhattan at the time?
Well, one, I think anybody who was working on that project felt very, very lucky, because there simply wasn't any work around. But the building of Rockefeller Center also had followed the building of the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. And lessons were really learned at both those buildings as they went up, even though they were very different situations, sites, as I said. They simply set an example of speed, of isolating their project from the rest of the world. I mean, iron steel building was still going up. There was a subway being built by the government, and the workers who worked there were not necessarily contained, I don't know a better word for it, by their situation and by the circumstances that they were working. If you worked for Rock Center, you obviously showed up on time. You showed up sober, not drunk. And and you showed up to work and keep your job, because keeping a job in 1932, 33, 34 was paramount among the efforts that people put in.
Interesting. Well, and related to that one is what are your thoughts of the context of labor involved as well, too? I mean, you mentioned earlier the Ludlow Massacre. I mean, this is coming at the end of an incredible era of labor and capital tensions. And then, yeah, as you just pointed out, like capital had, you know, what capital existed had all the upper hand during the Depression there as well, too. I mean, was there any labor strife involved with any of this? Or was it just purely like pure thankfulness, as you said, in this regard, too? Right. And then was that part of the image as well, as to show the treatment of labor and the dignity of the labor in this as part of its social contract to build it?
I think you hit the right word on the head, dignity. I think not only did the builders, through Todd, who was, as I said, a hard man with most people, but he was also a fair man. You got what you were paid to do. It was clear. It was concise. You would show up on time. This is your job. You should come with your union card. You only worked union people on the job. And you went home paid. It was a gift at that period of time. And people were not about to so-called blow it. They were not going to let this fall out of their hands because they were risking their whole family's livelihood on making sure that they showed up for work as well.
This photograph would be impossible to take today. Of course, people could easily generate something like this with AI, but it wouldn't be the same thing. You know, nowadays, if you go on a construction site, you can't even take photos of workers because there might be an OSHA violation and they don't want that to get out. There was no such thing as OSHA at this time. They weren't wearing helmets. They weren't wearing anything, any kind of safety gear.
OSHA didn't come along till what, 1972? Something like that, under Nixon, I think, yeah.
Right, and so they didn't even have helmets, you know, grips, cables, anything. I mean, they were just up there on their own. What was the sort of the rate of accidents that was happening on this project relative to contemporary projects? Not that there were very many contemporaries of that scale, but did they have a pretty good record there?
Apparently, we know of three accidents. Of course, you have to realize that Rockefeller is hiring Todd, who is hiring the construction people, the demolition people, the people who are putting up the steel structure. So there are sort of walls between each section going back to Rockefeller. So that if you got hurt on the job, it usually fell back to the person who was either say plastering a wall or something or falling off an iron beam. And they were very much separated from the actual owners of the property, Rockefeller, by layers of other corporations that they had to report to.
Sure, you have contractors, layers of subcontractors, a lot of fingers to point.
I think it's layers, absolutely. And, you know, you find that on any... The thing that amazed me is how quickly the Empire State Building went up in a year and how quickly Rockefeller Center went up. When you think of all the buildings that are there, how fast they built them and how well they built them, and how forward-thinking they were in the sense of light, transportation, air, which is all part of what Hood brought to the conversation in particular. You know, in order to make this successful, we should have the subway should come in to Rockefeller Center. There should be a station at Rockefeller Center. They even talked about having a bus terminal. Thank God they didn't do that. But they do have a parking garage because the automobile was becoming important. You don't find a parking garage at the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, but you do find it at Rockefeller Center. So they were trying to meet modern needs and necessities and still create an atmosphere. And the atmosphere had, as I said, to paraphrase Hood, Hood was concerned with having light where the central core of any building was where you'd contain the elevators. And the people had access to the offices that looked out the windows. I have a couple of wonderful windows in the archives that unfortunately archives don't like light, so I have to keep the shades down most of the time. It was a learning time for everybody, and I think that they had the good fortune of having one man paying the bills and one man running the operation. So you had a, not a marriage, but an agreement between these men as to how this would operate and how it would move forward.
Christine, this has been a fascinating conversation. This is such a fascinating project, you know, both for what it stands for and continues to stand for today, very ahead of its time. It was a kind of a milestone turning point in the history of public relations and publicity, and you know the power of the media. It just represents so many things to so many people, I think. And it's good to hear this dimension about it. It's like, it's crazy that this photo's been around for, you know, more than 80 years, and it's still so full of mystery, and despite its ubiquity. So thanks for sharing with us your attempts to sort of unwind this mystery.
You know, they even did such basic things like in one building, 45 Plaza building I'm in, they had gas lines run up to accommodate dentist's office. So 45 became known as the dental building to most of us who grew up in New York City. Their parents took us to 45 Rockefeller Center to get our fillings because the dentists all had been given this lifeline of gas that came up. They didn't need the tanks delivered. They had it direct. It was this kind of forward thinking and accommodating of people's needs, and was very much a forward moving. It still is. I will say Tishman does a good job of keeping the atmosphere right.
This has been another episode of Unfrozen, number 120, Lunch on a Beam. Our guest today is Christine Roussel, archivist at Rockefeller Center and author of the book on one of the more famous photographs in the history of news photography. Thanks again, Christine, for joining us.
Check my paranoia.